Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, December 5th through Saturday, December 7th, feature guest conductor Dima Slobodaniuk and cellist Johannes Moser. The program includes Suite No. 1 from Peer Gynt by Edvard Grieg, Cello Concerto by Witold Ludoslavsky, and after intermission, Symphony No. 1 by Sergei Rachmaninoff. And here are program notes by guest annotator Stephen Stuckey on the Ludoslavsky Cello Concerto, a work lasting about 23 minutes. Ludoslavsky is widely considered Poland's greatest composer since Chopin. Born to an influential family of intellectuals and politicians in Warsaw in 1913, he studied violin and piano as a boy and began composing at the age of 9. He took mathematics at Warsaw University but soon switched full-time to music, studying composition under Witold Maliszewski, himself a student of Rimsky-Korsakov, and graduating from the Warsaw Conservatory in both piano, 1936, and composition, 1937. Ludoslavsky's music can be thought of as falling into three style periods. Of the early works to about 1956, often summarized under the inadequate label neoclassic, the Paganini variations for two pianos, the Concerto for Orchestra, and Musique Funèbre are best known. Through much of this early period, he pursued two independent styles, one for functional music, often folk-inspired, Concerto for Orchestra, the other experimental and driven by an insatiable urge to perfect a personal, independent, modernist musical language, the First Symphony, Overture for Strings, and Musique Funèbre. The turbulent events shaping Polish life in the first half of the century affected the composer's life and music again and again. He was taken prisoner by the German army early in the Second World War, later led a precarious existence in occupied Warsaw, and after the war was subjected to official censure by the Stalinist government in Poland for his modernist tendencies, an action that drove his experimental works underground. Ludoslavsky's middle period, 1956 to 1979, likewise corresponds to a chapter in his country's history, from the partial easing of political and artistic repression in the 50s to the unrest that spawned the Solidarity Movement 20 years later. The works from these years typically feature a limited use of chance techniques to create elaborately colorful rhythms combined with rich harmonies based chiefly on 12-note chords. In these works, texture, instrumentation, and timbre often assume leading roles. After about 1979, however, Ludoslavsky adopted still another approach, now stressing thinner, simpler textures and harmonies, and lucid, even neoclassic melodic and rhythmic lines, elements that, in turn, create obvious connections with his early works. Among the best-known compositions of the late period are the monumental Third Symphony, commissioned by the Chicago Symphony and premiered here under Sir George Schulte in 1983, the great violin works Partita from 1984 for Pinka Zukerman, and Chain 2, 1985 for Anisofa Mutter, for whom Ludoslavsky was also writing an unfinished concerto at the time of his death, the Piano Concerto, 1988 for Christian Zimmermann, and the Fourth Symphony from 1992, for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. It's already clear that a number of Ludoslavsky's pieces from each of his three style periods have achieved that rare distinction for a late 20th century composer, a secure place in the repertory. These would surely include Musique Funèbre, Dance Preludes, the Concerto for Orchestra, the String Quartet, and the Third Symphony. The Piano Concerto and Fourth Symphony are showing signs of staying power, too. And with such exponents as Mstislav Rostropovich, Yo-Yo Ma, Natalia Gutman, Heinrich Schiff, and Lynn Harrell, the Cello Concerto has long been a staple of the cello repertory. The idea of a cello concerto was planted by Rostropovich himself in the early 1960s, while the opportunity to realize it came in 1968 when a commission arrived from the Royal Philharmonic Society in London, supported by funds from the Gulbenkian Foundation. Work on the score occupied all of 1969 and the first part of 1970. All the hallmarks of the middle period style are at their peak in the concerto. the lively rhythmic textures, the masterly orchestral colors, the rich and complex harmonies, the deep urge for humane communication, and the flair for high drama. Indeed, it is drama that comes to mind in the cello concerto, driven in no small part by the outsized personality of its first protagonist. Lutosławski himself was always on guard against interpreting his works according to external programs. Both by personal temperament and by philosophy, he was an old-school defender of the notion of absolute music, in which all the meaning is embodied in the purely musical relationships. Yet in this work, extra musical associations are frankly unavoidable. The composer himself sent the solo part to Rostropovich page by page as the work progressed, with explanations couched largely in terms of a scenario in which the solo cello and orchestra confront each other as adversaries. This concept appealed strongly to the cellist, and he developed a deep identification with the dramatic persona represented in the solo part. Even so, Rostropovich's wife, soprano Galina Veshtovskaya, is surely going too far when she refers to the work as the story of a 20th century Don Quixote. The first performance was given by Rostropovich and the Bournemouth Symphony in London on October 14, 1970. Rostropovich was scheduled to repeat the work in Moscow in May 1971 and in Warsaw in September 1971, but outside events soon lent additional drama. In punishment for his defiant letter to Soviet authorities protesting the vilification of writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn and recalling similar attacks on Shostakovich and Pasternak, Rostropovich was fired from his teaching post at the Moscow Conservatory and forbidden to travel, and the Moscow concert was canceled. Even when the Russian premiere finally took place in December 1972, greeted by a massive ovation in the concert hall, no mention of the concert was permitted in the Soviet press. Lutosławski's approach to the concerto genre was not to revive its traditional 19th-century rhetorical or formal patterns, but to reformulate its essential principles in an original way. Thus, although the solo part represents formidable technical challenges, it has no empty virtuosity for its own sake. There is no cadenza. The music runs without pause for about 24 minutes, but it falls into four clearly defined movements: an introductory monologue for the soloist, a series of dialogues between the cellist and the orchestra, a slow movement, and finally, the main event, an extended finale. While opening monologue aside, these movements reflect the usual fast-slow-fast pattern of older concertos. Their functions have been drastically altered to suit Lutosławski's rather different needs. The introduction finds the cellist as if an actor alone in an empty theater, musing absent-mindedly to himself, trying on now one character, now another. Finally, he is interrupted by the brusque intrusion of trumpets, playing what the composer called an irascible phrase. This very first utterance from the ranks of the orchestra serves immediate notice of the hostile, disruptive role the orchestra will assume, a role that will be fully developed later in the dramatic confrontations of the finale. Though the cellist attempts to continue his soliloquy, the trumpets intrude again and again, erupting finally in an extended statement. Now, the cellist tries a different tack. Having failed to sustain his monologue, he tries to engage the orchestra in dialogue. Each of the four episodes that comprise this second movement unfolds in the same way. The cellist issues a kind of invitation in isolated pizzicato notes, and a colloquy ensues between soloist and small groups of instruments, at first haltingly, but gradually becoming more fluent. Throughout these exchanges, the cellist continues to explore a kaleidoscopic range of manners, by turns gentle, brilliant, playful, pathetic, lyrical, comic. The brasses, excluded from these dialogues, continue to play the disruptive outside force, breaking in fortissimo to cut each episode short before it has fully developed. The last such intrusion, marking the end of the second movement, is an extended and virulent one like that which ended the introduction. In the slow, expressive third movement, the orchestral strings join with the cellist in an eloquent cantilena of a type that Charles Bodman Ray has aptly called the dolente, or sorrowful melody, recognizable by its sobbing grace note figures and its almost folk-song-like adherence to a few simple melodic intervals. The form of this melody in the cello concerto became a prototype for similar melodies in a number of later works, including the Third Symphony. In form, the slow movement is like a da capo aria, cantilena, contrasting middle section, return of the cantilena. The final string unison accelerates, becomes urgent, seems to bode a climax, but again is ruthlessly cut short, this time by the entire brass section. And the finale, in which the real action of the concerto will transpire, is rudely underway. Now the other orchestral groups join in a series of attacks against the struggling soloist. Eventually, the soloist mounts a furious countercharge, leading to a series of skirmishes in which smaller groups of instruments seem to taunt him. The orchestra, apparently victorious, reaches a climax, delivering 11 ferocious blows. Vanquished, the cellist can only whimper in reply. Before the premiere, Rostropovich confessed to Ludosławski that he always wept during this passage. "It is my death," he said. "But Slava," replied the composer, "you will triumph in the end." And so he shall. For in the short coda, the soloist rises, indomitable, ascending brilliantly from the bottom of his instrument to its very top, proclaiming with his final insistent cries a transcendent message. The individual will to survive. Program notes by Stephen Stuckey on the cello concerto by Ludosławski. And now on to Symphony No. 1 by Sergei Rachmaninoff. The work lasts about 41 minutes. Rachmaninoff would have become famous even if he had done nothing but play the piano. But his true aspiration was to become a composer. At the Moscow Conservatory, his teacher, Nikolai Zverev, encouraged him to stick to the piano instead of writing music, and resented his taking composition classes with Sergei Taneyev and Anton Arensky. After Rachmaninoff tried his hand at composing some piano pieces, he even started an opera, Esmeralda, he realized that he was unable to choose between composition and performance, and so he ultimately decided to pursue both, eventually, by the way, becoming a fine conductor as well. In 1889, the year he and Zverev parted ways, he sketched and abandoned a piano concerto, but the one he began the following year is his first major work, the one that became his Opus 1. This is the score that sealed his fate as a composer, and it was completed in a rush of passion and elation, with Rachmaninoff working from 5 in the morning until 8 in the evening and scoring the last two movements in just 2.5 days. Rachmaninoff played the first movement with orchestra in a concert of student works at the conservatory in March 1892. He played it with the Chicago Symphony when he made his debut in Orchestra Hall on December 3, 1909, the first of his 8 performances with the orchestra. Rachmaninoff quickly began to draw attention as a composer. The brooding piano prelude in C-sharp minor he composed in 1892 at the age of 19 immediately became the calling card of a young artist's dreams, and eventually a burden as well. Audiences would not let him leave the stage until he played the work, a work he eventually referred to dismissively as it. In 1893, Tchaikovsky, who was already impressed with Rachmaninoff's talent, interrupted work on his final symphony, the Pathétique, to attend the premiere of Rachmaninoff's first opera, Aleko, based on Pushkin's poem, The Gypsies. But the real mark of a 19th-century composer was the symphony. And so, at the age of 22, and in the same decade as Tchaikovsky's Pathétique, Brahms' Fourth, Saint-Saëns' Organ, Mahler's First, Bruckner's Eighth, and Dvorak's New World, Rachmaninoff set out to write a symphony. In truth, he had already tested the waters, first with an orchestral scherzo he wrote at the age of 13, then with an allegro composed shortly after his first piano concerto. He was now ready to join the company of the great romantic symphonist. And as he began his new symphony in D minor, he was filled with excitement and assurance. Work went well, ideas came to him swiftly, and his enthusiasm did not wane. But with the premiere of his first symphony in St. Petersburg, 1897, under the baton of composer Alexander Glazunov, Rachmaninoff's confidence and momentum, if not his entire career, suddenly seemed to fizzle. The performance must have been appalling. Rachmaninoff called it the most agonizing hour of my life. He hid in a stairwell with his hands over his ears. Glazunov was later said to have been drunk when he walked on stage. And the opening night review by composer Cesar Cui, the only member of the so-called Russian Five, whose music is never performed today, could hardly have been worse. The symphony, Cui concluded, would have brought ecstasy to the inhabitants of hell. The audience response was scarcely warmer, though many listeners that night may have suspected what Rachmaninoff had already learned the hard way, that for all his prestige in Russian musical circles, Glazunov was a lousy conductor. How could so great a musician as Glazunov conduct so badly? Rachmaninoff later asked. It is not even a question of his conducting technique, poor as that is, but of his musicianship. He beats time as if he had no feeling for music at all. Nevertheless, the damage had been done, and Rachmaninoff could not recover his nerve or his musical ambitions. Much later, he recalled, "The despair that filled my soul would not leave me. My dreams of a brilliant career lay shattered. My hopes and confidence were destroyed." Rachmaninoff withdrew the symphony and refused to have it published, as if suppressing the score would also erase the memory. For the next 3 years, he wrote nothing. Sketches for a new symphony were abandoned, and work on an opera, Francesca da Rimini, was shelved. He continued to perform and even undertook a concert tour to London in 1898, but day after day, he found that he was unable to compose. As he grew more despondent, his friends began to recommend various remedies. Twice, he visited Leo Tolstoy, once by himself, and once with the bass, Fyodor Shalyapin, hoping that contact with the great novelist would shake him out of his slump and jumpstart his creativity. But the writer's self-serving platitudes discouraged him even more. "You must work," Tolstoy told him. "I work every day." When he and Shalyapin performed one of Rachmaninoff's songs, Tolstoy wasted no words in conveying how much he disliked it. Finally, fearing that Rachmaninoff was trapped in a serious depression, his family suggested that he consult Dr. Nikolai Dahl, a Paris internist who had become a specialist in curing alcoholism through hypnosis. At the end of 1899, after months of almost daily sessions, Rachmaninoff was again able to face the challenge of writing a large-scale orchestral work, and he began a new piano concerto. But even with the wild success of his second piano concerto, one of the most popular and beloved works in the form, the idea of composing a symphony still haunted and terrified him. When he did unveil a second symphony, 10 years after the first, Rachmaninoff swore it would be his last. And then, 28 years later, he started work on the third symphony that did, in fact, turn out to be the final one of his career. The four movements of Rachmaninoff's first symphony are unified by a single idea introduced immediately after the slow introduction to the first movement that echoes the shape of the Dies Irae, the familiar phrase from the sequence for the Gregorian Mass for the Dead that would recur in several of Rachmaninoff's most important works over the years, including The Isle of the Dead, which, by the way, the Chicago Symphony performs at the end of March and explores in greater depth in Beyond the Score. Each of the subsequent movements opens with a reference to this motto. The second movement, Scherzo, is fleet and light-footed. The expansive Larghetto is the prototype of the great slow movements in the symphonies and concertos yet to come. The finale is grand, festive, occasionally flamboyant, and sometimes menacing, and here Rachmaninoff's signature melody comes closest to actually quoting the Dies Irae theme. The entire score is strong, highly individual, and self-assured. It is the work of a young talent overflowing with ideas, not an artist paralyzed by failure. Although Rachmaninoff never destroyed his score for the First Symphony, leaving it behind when he left Russia to settle in the West, eventually it was given up for lost. After the composer's death, a two-piano transcription of the symphony surfaced in Moscow, followed by a set of orchestral parts at the conservatory in St. Petersburg. In March 1945, the symphony was performed in Moscow for the first time since its 1897 premiere. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra played it for the first time in February 2010. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 1. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.